Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Today is Monday, October 10th. My name's Arden Swelling. Ben Nicholson-Smith is with me, as always, our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. Ben, what the hell just happened? What happened?
Oh, man. I
Who
have
are
no
we?
Idea.
What is baseball? What happened to the Toronto Blue Jays? Explain life for me, please.
I will do my best. I offer no promises on that front. I guess, first of all, thanks to anyone who's listening at this point, because it was that weekend was enough to take a lot out of anyone, any Blue Jays fan for sure. So thanks for being here with us, trying to understand what happened. I don't know. Like, I find it very difficult to explain. We do know the Jays were up 8-1 at home in a game that they absolutely should have won. And they lost it. And that's pretty devastating for the Blue Jays players, for the coaches, for their fans, for everyone in the organization. I just think every one of these chances, when you have a healthy, young core like this, each chance is hard to come by. And so I just don't see a silver lining here. I just think it sucks and they're done.
So two things. First of all, and I have trouble explaining this to people, but it's like, I feel like I've like come out of a vacuum, or like I come out of a dream, right? Like, you think about it.
Yeah.
What, Ben, like the lockout ended in early March, and like you and I and Shy and everybody else who works on this, and obviously like the Toronto Blue Jays themselves, have been just like at it every day since. Things went from like 0 to 100 with lockout ending in early March. 7 straight months, every single day at it. Every single day I wake up just like, all right, what happened last night with the Blue Jays? What did I see? What are my thoughts on it? How do I contextualize it? What do I think it means? How do I connect it to greater themes? Like, what will I say if I am asked this about it? How am I going to write about it? How am I going to talk about it? What do I think about it? Like, every day, just building into that night's game, into the next contest, which is typically coming like within 24 hours. And then also like, okay, I woke up and I'm in Baltimore, and in like physical time and space, I need to be in Pittsburgh later, or like whatever, like just all of those thoughts and just everything that just like consumes your entire life. All that 7 months for 28 hours of playoff baseball. Like, it goes from 100 to 0 like that. And it's just like, whoosh. You're just like out of the vacuum so quickly. Game one started Friday at 4 o'clock. Game two ended Saturday at 8:20. 28 hours. And it was just, whoosh. Life changed. Like, it's, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around it.
100%. And I think, too, like along those lines, you know, even within Saturday afternoon, a period of, I think the game was 4 hours and 10 minutes, something like that.
4:20, I think it was, yeah.
Long game. Long game. A lot happened in that game. We'll obviously get to all of that. But there was a period of time, like, the Jays are up 8-1. I'm sitting in there with Shy and Blair and David Singh in the press box. I'm going to Shy. Like, we're talking about flights, right? Because we're thinking, you, me, and Shy, we're going to go to Houston. It's like, okay, obviously, you know, we have to be ready for this. You know, they've got, at that point, all this momentum. They're playing great. It's like, all right, this is getting to the point that we need to be ready logistically to move our physical selves to Houston. So it's like, get things ready, make sure that we're ready for that contingency. Of course, you're planning for the game itself as well. Like, I had written, keep in mind, Teoscar Hernandez in this game, he had the game of a friggin' lifetime. Yeah. Season on the line, his team facing elimination. Teo goes out and hits 2 home runs against the defending Cy Young.
Swing and a drive again. Teoscar has done it again. A 2-homer game for Teo.
Like, what a game. So I had written this whole story about Teoscar, 800 words in. I know Shy had a whole gamer written. David had a piece written as well. They all just get scrapped. So you're sitting there like, and then the energy just disappears from the building. And of course it does, because, you know, again, this is just, I know it's easy to say like this team is young and this team is going to do so many special things. We don't know that. They might miss the playoffs next year, or they might have injuries next year that prevent them from reaching the playoffs in full health the way they did right now. And so I'm not going to try to find a silver lining right here. I just think you only get so many shots with a team this talented, and now one of those shots is gone.
The Teoscar game it would have been. Because think about also how he hit those home runs. One of them was off a left-handed slider, Teoscar Hernandez, who does not hit left-handed sliders out of the ballpark. A guy who actually like chases left-handed sliders at nearly a 60% rate. A guy who the night prior in game one had an absolutely miserable game against Luis Castillo, making early outs, chasing, grounding into double plays in big spots. I mean, a guy who like showed up in a huge way. And we're not even going to talk about that. There's a million moments from that game. Yep. Matt Chapman diving into first base. We're not even going to talk mm-hmm. about that. That would have been like an iconic moment if the circumstances had been different. But broadcasting that game, I was in the booth with Ben Wagner, and it's like similar thing, right? Like I'm thinking about game three, midway through game two, and I'm thinking about, wow, Blue Jays are getting into like Seattle's bullpen right now. Like they are softening up that bullpen for game three. I'm thinking about the Blue Jays pitcher usage and just like, wow, like how does John Schneider keep like just enough powder dry so he can get through game three? I'm thinking about like Ross Stripling, who was going to start game three, thinking about like, what's his outing look like? How much length can they get out of him? Like, how is he preparing for it? Ross Stripling literally was already preparing during game two. He was going over his scouting reports for game three. Wow. Like, he was preparing his attack plan in the Blue Jays clubhouse during game two. Like, he was mentally looking at game three and how he was going to pitch that outing. But, like, to your point about trying to explain it and like feeling like you can't, game two of that series and that series as a whole, like it was just, that was just baseball. Like that's just a sport that like is not always fair. Like it doesn't have to make rational sense. It's chaotic. Like it's volatile. Insane things happen. You're hitting one round object with another round object. And like you can prepare yourself like as well as possible. And the Blue Jays do. And they think about these things in insanely granular detail and try to push the percentage points in either direction and give themselves the best possible opportunity to win and to have outcomes come go their way. But it's still a game, and it's not always going to, like, as much as we like want things to make sense and want there to be one culprit, one thing to blame, one reason that something happened, it never really orders up that perfectly. Like it's never that logical and rational. It's just a crazy sport and crazy things happen.
100%. And so, you know, I think with that in mind, be cautious of any narratives that come out surrounding this game, right? Like it's, you know, there's so many little things that contribute. And I think anyone who was in that building that day, which, you know, the crowd, by the way, was really into it, did a great job to get on Robbie Ray, seemingly, respectfully enough. It's not like they're throwing things at him, but they're chanting. They're getting under his skin. He was ineffective. So the crowd did a great job. So anyway, from the crowd to the players, to the coaches, team staff, anyone that you're talking to afterwards. And I know you and I both had a lot of conversations after that game, Arden. Everyone was confused. No one had a simple explanation. So if the people in the building who are on the field for it, in the dugout for it, if they don't have a simple explanation, I'm just not sure that one exists. And I'm not sure that we're going to do ourselves that many favors by seeking one out. So again, probably makes sense to be cautious if someone says, Jay's lost because X, Jay's lost because Y. I mean, again, that's not to say that the loss is in any way less painful or that the Blue Jays haven't lost something significant by flaming out in two games or that they didn't blow it, because of course they blew it, but I'm just not sure there's one simple explanation for that loss.
I don't know that they blew it as much as like the Seattle Mariners took it, you know, as much as like baseball just baseballed. I felt like the Blue Jays clubhouse after game two like wasn't as down as maybe I might have thought it would be, and I think that's just because of like how emotionally draining and how insane that game was and how everybody, to your point, just kind of threw up their hands. Just like, okay, like that happened, you know, like you almost couldn't be that sad and dispirited afterwards. Look, like Kevin Gausman called it heartbreaking. Jordan Romano described the feeling as despair. Like these are, you know, strong words, absolutely. But like, I felt like the team honestly was more down after missing the playoffs by a game in 2021 than they were after this Mariners series. Do you agree with me?
I don't agree or disagree. I don't necessarily remember that closely. And of course, we were not in the clubhouse last year, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. So
yeah, I'm even thinking just from like the Zoom avails that we had with guys, right? And just from the conversations even in spring when people were still like pissed off about it and really upset about missing the playoffs by one game. Like people were still talking about it months later.
100%. I think they'll be talking about this one for a long time. I really do. But you're right. I think in the moment, like afterwards, and there's something about athletes here and baseball players where you spend 6-7 months saying, onto the next, wash it, onto the next. And you do that after every single loss. And even good teams lose all the time, right? So they've lost 70 plus times this year. They have that experience of saying, okay, wash it, onto the next. And I think some of that muscle memory almost takes over even after a huge loss. Now, there were guys like Vladdy, Biggio was in the dugout, just staring out at the Mariners celebrating, you know, in the clubhouse after the game. You see Manoah kind of just sitting there, Chapman and Bo talking in hushed tones to one another, Vladdy packing up his locker, pretty downcast. But then you have others who, you know, process it differently. It's hard to compare, and it's obviously unfortunate for the Blue Jays to even have to entertain such a comparison, because I think in both cases, there's such a feeling of like unfulfillment, because in 2021, they obviously didn't get the chance to play a single playoff game. And now this group has gone another season without winning a playoff game. So this group has not actually won a playoff game together yet.
We need like, what, an entire episode to talk about game two, essentially. And we'll do it in the second half. But let's just like talk quickly about game one and what happened there and just what we saw from Luis Castillo. And we can get to Alek Manoah and his outing. But like, my goodness, when a guy takes the mound with not one, but two fastballs that he is sitting 99 with and then hitting 100 with. And we're now talking about like a four seamer that he is dotting away from right-handed hitters and just like right on the edge of the strike zone away from them. And then a two seamer that he's like driving in on their hands and that has like giddy up right into their kitchen. And look, big leaguers can hit velocity, like big leaguers face upper 90s stuff all the time. The Blue Jays saw more of it than any team in baseball this year. The Blue Jays saw it like 20.2% of the pitches the Blue Jays faced this year were 95 plus. That was the most across MLB. And the team hit 260 against them, 324 WOBA. Like they did fine against premium velocity. The Blue Jays can hit really hard stuff like Luis Castillo was throwing. But the challenge and the thing that made it impossible that day is that it was two of those pitches with that velocity moving in different directions, put you in an absolutely impossible situation. And then, oh, by the way, let me just locate these sliders down and away. So I'm coming right up against you with that two-seamer and getting you to bend back in the batter's box at your hip. And then I'm making you lunge out at these sliders down and away from you. And oh, by the way, I'm Luis Castillo. I have like this phenomenal changeup that I barely even need on this day because I am so perfect with everything else. Like when you take like four plus pitches with amazing command into an outing, Ben, if you put like the 1927 Yankees in there and it was like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and these guys, could they have done anything about against Luis Castillo? Like, I just don't think that anyone was beating Castillo on that day.
100%. And not to get back into our Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig debates here, because some might say that he would have no-hit them. Honestly, the stuff from Castillo was the best stuff I've seen in person all year. I mean, I've seen Bieber and McClanahan and Ohtani, and we've seen a lot of really good pitching against the Blue Jays this year. That was the best stuff I've seen all year. When you combine it with the location, like you said, the two fastballs going 99, the slider, the changeup, the setting, the stakes, the strength of the opposing lineup. I know it's a very right-handed lineup and Castillo matches up well against right-handers, but to me, this was the most impressive pitching performance that I've seen in person all year. He was incredible. That's why you give up two top 50 prospects to get him. What a great trade by the Mariners to acquire Castillo, and that now has pushed them forward to facing the Houston Astros. So, and by the way, the Jays had some interest in Castillo. I am led to understand that they were never a front runner for him this summer, but they did have some interest in July. And clearly, this is why you go out and get a pitcher like that. And we can get to this later, but there were times that, you know, maybe the Jays bullpen and pitching staff was a little short this series, could have used a little bit more, certainly, not to make this into a, you know, let's reassess the trade deadline. But this is an amazing move by the Mariners. And Castillo was as dominant as it gets. So to me, that was a game, you know, you talk about, did the Mariners win? Did the Blue Jays lose it? This is a game the Mariners won. I would not fault the Blue Jays for this one. They were just outplayed. They were just completely outplayed, and they didn't make mistakes, but Castillo was dominant, and the Mariners earned that win.
Well, and I think the Blue Jays feel they made the second best offer for Frankie Montas at the trade deadline. So if you're in on Montas to that extent, I would imagine you have a lot of interest in Luis Castillo as well, who's a better pitcher, right? And who like showed it in that outing. And it was interesting coming into it. He had a couple clunkers down the stretch against some not great opposition, right? Like two of his final three outings, he did not have that stuff that he had at Rogers Center. But then, you know, as you said, I would put that up with the Ohtani outing against the Blue Jays, and then also the one Dylan Cease threw against them in Chicago, which I was at. Like that was a crazy day for Cease as well. But I mean, just and it's funny, man, with Castillo, like I didn't think the Blue Jays had a bad approach against him. Like I didn't think that, like, I, you know, a lot of times guys are overmatched, and a lot of times guys were chasing because how do you not? But I thought like the Blue Jays battled him, man. Like Luis Castillo gave up more hits in that outing than Alek Manoah did. You know, like I thought the Blue Jays were like finding ways to get bats on balls. Like they were not striking out a lot until I think it was the seventh when Castillo struck out the side. But until that point, Blue Jays were putting balls in play. They were, you know, trying to work counts against him. They were doing a really good job. I just don't think that there was a good enough job to be done against Castillo. And it's almost unfair when you say, well, all right, Castillo's done for the day. Let's go ahead and like change speeds on this lineup and make the speed go up to Andreas Munoz. Let's take out friggin' Luis Castillo, who carried 99 into the sixth inning, and let's bring in a reliever who's going to throw even harder and go up to like 102, 103. I think that like Alek Manoah on the other side had to be perfect for the Blue Jays to win that game.
Yeah, and just on Castillo first in the approach there, you see Kirk taking at the opposite field, down the right field line. Springer taking it into the right center field gap, going the opposite way. So the Jays doing what you probably should do against elite velocity and staying back on it, making solid contact. It's all they could do. It was not enough. And like you said, I mean, Manoah would have had to be perfect. And he was not. Like he came out, in my opinion, a little bit too amped up. He was throwing 95s. He hit Julio Rodriguez. You know, he obviously made a bad pitch to Cal Raleigh, and Raleigh punished it and sent it over the wall for his second massive home run in the span of 8 days for the Mariners, also including his shot that sent them into the playoffs. So, yeah, I mean, Manoah was okay. He was okay. He wasn't great. He wasn't pinpoint. He wasn't bad. He was okay.
Manoah, like, you could tell in the first inning he was spraying his fastball, right? Like he was kind of missing with like four seamers, arm side, like up and out, right? And so, you know, somebody who is, you know, smarter than me can tell you what it was mechanically that made that happen. If he was flying open or like kind of if his legs were in front of his arm, things just weren't quite connected, but he was just spraying the fastball. That's why he hit Julio Rodriguez, right? Like that's just why he had that inconsistency. And then you saw him kind of trying to work through it in the first inning and trying to make that adjustment. Alek Manoah showed us this year, like he is exceptional at making in-game adjustments, whether that's for, you know, adjusting to what he's doing and his mechanics, his command, his location, or adjusting to the swings he's seeing from hitters and the way that hitters are attacking his stuff, and then sort of manipulating his game plan to sort of expose whatever their weakness is or to not give in to what they're trying to do to him. I think Alek Manoah is really good at making those adjustments. And I think he did ultimately make that adjustment after the first inning. It just came too late, because as he tried to adjust in the first inning, I think, and this is my opinion, I think he started trying to sort of finesse the fastball and like force himself back into the zone and really get that fastball on the plate. And that's when he left pitches up, and that's when he left pitches over the heart. And that's what the pitch to Cal Raleigh was, right? Like as a right-handed pitcher, you can't leave a pitch in that spot to Cal Raleigh, because Cal Raleigh has made his season on capitalizing on those mistakes from right-handed pitchers. All of his home runs have come against righties. They've all come against mistakes like that. He's a folk hero in Seattle right now, right? For what he did in this series.
Yep.
But I think like he worked his approach in that spot, and he got to his pitch and he didn't miss it. But after that, like after that pitch, we just saw the same old Alek Manoah, right? Like from the second through to whenever he came out, the fifth or sixth, like typical Alek Manoah, like quick outs, you know, moving off barrels, like doing his thing, working at a good tempo. Like he was fine after that. I mean, he just was shaky in that first inning, probably too amped up. You saw him, Ben, come out for his warm-up. It was a game that started at 4.07 p.m. He came out for his warm-up at 3 o'clock. Started warming up more than an hour before first pitch. I think that the guy took the start really, really, really seriously and like really put a lot of weight on himself to pitch for like for his team and for a city and for a country and to like carry over what he had established in what should be like a season that gets Cy Young recognition, like as in like consideration for the Cy Young. He's not going to win it, but he should be considered for it. I think he probably just like carried a bit too much weight and a bit too much pressure into that outing and maybe just like put a little bit too much on himself. It's a tough thing to like, it's tough to criticize a guy for that, right? Like you want that, you want players to care, but I do wonder if like Alek Manoah carried just a bit too much weight into that first inning.
Well, and you could tell afterwards, you know, how much it was weighing on him. Certainly he was pretty downcast in the press conference afterwards, even in the clubhouse afterwards, kind of just sitting by himself in his locker in the same scene after game two. I mean, this one hit hard. Obviously, he wanted to have the chance to get out there and perform better. But, you know, let me ask you this. Like, what do you think? Because his line about pressure is something you put in your tires, that was a line that obviously resonated with Jays fans, excited Jays fans beforehand. Scott Service took note. And in his pregame meeting, he said, I hope there's no pressure in those tires, kind of riffing off of that Manoah line. Kind of brings to mind the Vlad line too about the, you know, last year was the trailer, this year's the movie. So, you know, do you think that next year, do you think we hear stuff like that from the Jays again? Or do you think they're maybe a little quieter? Do you think that's part of who they are and they're just going to keep, you know, going with that bravado? Do you think they dial it back? Where do you think that leads?
I hope we hear things like that again from the Blue Jays. I want players to be forthcoming and I want them to speak their minds and feel comfortable to say whatever they want. I think it's ridiculous the way that people have like taken that last year's the trailer, this year's the movie line and like made it this weird signifier for disappointment in the Blue Jays season. Like I'm just so sick of people like dumping on that quote. And just like it's just one of the worst things that like the sports fan and media community does is just like bringing up something that a player said. When a player says something interesting once, like just once, like bringing it up when things don't go that player's way on the field or when a team doesn't like be, you know, finish as the literal only one team in baseball that won't finish the season disappointed, when they don't achieve that incredibly rare goal and bring it back. Oh, why would you say this in March if you were going to exit the playoffs in two games in October? Like, it's so ridiculous. What do you want them to say in spring training? Do you want them to come in and say like, you know, well, yeah, like last year, we bitterly disappointed all of you and ourselves by missing the playoffs by a game. And I'm thinking that this season will probably end 7 months from now in crushing disappointment once again. Get ready for the season, guys. You know how bad we disappointed you last year. We're going to disappoint you even worse this year. See you in 7 months. Peace. Like, just leave it, man. It's a quote. It's freaking 10 words that a guy said. Like, it means nothing. It means nothing. It's not a promise. He didn't come out and say, we are going to win the World Series. And if we don't, like, he didn't say anything like that. It doesn't entitle you to anything that this guy said this. It doesn't mean anything. It's a quote. It makes the game more fun and interesting and enjoyable. Why are you working against that? It drives me nuts. And it's the same thing with the pressure in the tires thing.
There were some really good points there. I think also worth remembering, it's not just the Jays. Like, you know, Edwin Diaz has his amazing closer entrance, right? We've discussed that on ATL, the Timmy Trumpet, that whole thing. And the Mets are out now. So I saw this morning, I saw some memes where, you know, they do the Diaz entrance, but then they overlap, they dub over like really sad trumpet music. And, you know, it's sort of funny, but it's also kind of cruel. And I think you're right. We want to allow for athletes to make bold statements, to be honest with us, for sure. And I think in an ideal world, we would encourage them to say what they think, even if it's a bit audacious, even if it's a bit bold. But we don't live in that world. So, which is why I asked you the question, do you think, you know, knowing that this is how sometimes these things get spun. And these guys are online. They might not be on Twitter as much as you and me, but you know, they're online. So I guess I just wonder if they do dial it back. Not that they should, not that I would want them to, but do they maybe react and say, you know what? This time we're just gonna keep this to ourselves. We're not gonna put it out there publicly in quite that same way, which would be a shame.
Is it even that audacious? Like, is it even that bold to just say, like, last year's the trailer, this year's the movie? Like,
or pressure say, something like, you put in your tires. Yeah.
Is that so audacious, right? Like, right. Bold would be like, these Seattle Mariners jamokes. We're going to, like, sweep them out of the city. We're not even taking them seriously. They suck. We're the best. They don't deserve this. We've earned it. Screw them. Like, that would have been audacious and bold. Nobody said that. Right? 99.9% of sports quotes are just, we're taking the opponent very seriously and we've got to earn it. Yep. We're trying to give 110% and like work really hard and blah, 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 blah. Right? And the 0.1% that is like just a marginally interesting. These aren't even really good quotes, man. Like, last year was a trailer, this year's the movie, just isn't even that like inventive or creative or interesting. Honestly, it's not even that great. Pressure is not something you put in your tires. Air is something you put in your, like oxygen is something you put in your tires. Tires have pressure, but like the quote didn't even make sense, honestly. So like the fact that people like ascribe so much to these like little throwaway lines that athletes say to just make our lives like a little bit more interesting and then want to throw it back in their faces when they fail and when they're disappointed that their team didn't win. Man, I could not be more fatigued of that BS.
I like that. That's a good take.
Can you just share an opinion on this, please? What do you
think? No, man, I agree with you. Like, that's why I'm saying. Like, I'm saying I think that's a good take.
So do you? What do you think? Answer your own question. Like, you posed. So what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, you're right. We want athletes to be entertaining. Agreed. Okay. It is a shame that when they say something like, this is the movie you're going to want to watch, you know, that gets thrown back in their face. It's a shame. And then to answer my own question, I think these guys dial it back next year. I don't think we hear stuff like that from them, because I think that it's one more hassle for them to have to deal with potentially. It's one more downside. And I think that we see them go about their business in a not in a less fun way, but I think that publicly they're not going to put that stuff out there quite in the same way. That's my prediction.
More boring, monochromatic, like monotonous, going through the motions, cliches. That's what you think.
Well, until they win. Because again, this group has not yet won a game, right? They have not yet won a playoff game. So I think at this point, they dial back the bravado until they win a playoff game. Not saying they should. It's a long season. Again, it goes back to our celebration conversation from last week. You win a playoff berth, a division, you deserve to celebrate. You deserve to celebrate. But for them to kind of to get to, you know, to use the team's hashtag here, to get to that next level, it's not just getting into the playoffs. You can't keep taking one little incremental step at a time. At a certain point, you have to take leaps, right? Because otherwise, you know, next year, okay, great, they get to the division series, then the LCS, then all of a sudden, Vlad and Bo are free agents and you've got to the World Series and like, but you haven't won anything still. So I think that if I had to predict, I just think they dial it back a little bit more.
It's just so,
and that's not a good thing. I'm not saying that's a good thing. No,
it's not. It's so tedious, man. It's so tiresome. It's entertainment. It's an entertainment product. At the end of the day, that's what it is. That's why we're watching, to be entertained. And holy smokes, like if you were not entertained by game two of this series, like I don't know, man. Like go try something else. Like go watch something else. I don't think baseball's for you. It's one of the best baseball games I've ever seen in my life as a pure entertainment product. Like I don't know how I did not walk away from that unsatisfied. Like as a Blue Jays fan, you can be like disappointed that your team didn't win, but like as in terms of like just competition and like athletics and just like, well, you know, did you not get your money's worth with that game?
Well, I mean, I'll say this, it was incredibly entertaining. I think that game would have been a perfect game to watch as a neutral fan. If you're a Brewers fan, if you're a Cincinnati Reds fan, what a perfect game to watch. And if you're a Blue Jays fan, absolutely horrifying.
Like, what are we watching this for, though? It's to be entertained, right? It's like to take our minds off of like how crushingly dispiriting life is at all other times. So like, what? That's what this is about. So what more did you want other than your team winning,
a win.
I guess?
But yeah, a win.
There was a win in the game.
Yes. Just I think our audience wanted a Blue Jays win.
We should talk about that game, and we will. And so much more. when we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producers are Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. I've gone for a very long walk and, stared into the abyss and recollected myself. People are going to think that was planned, Ben. Like, I had no idea you were even going to bring that up.
I didn't know that I was going to bring it up either. Yeah, it was just kind of spur of the moment, and I started putting these things together, and I thought, I wonder what Arden thinks about this. And I'm glad I asked. That was found out. Great reply.
It's about 7 months in the pressure cooker of baseball, and they had to let off a little steam. Let's let off a little more steam, because it's time now for Major League Beer for Major League Baseball, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Ben, we've seen it now. We've seen the new MLB playoff format, the new three-game wild card round, four series, all three games hosted by the home team. Kind of interesting. Three of the four series were sweeps. Three of the four series won by the road club. But just what did you think of our first example of this new format?
So, of course, it didn't work for the Jays, and you can blame a lot of different things for that, whether it's the players, the umpires, the manager, of course. We'll get to all that, but I don't think you can blame the format at all. And to me, honestly, when you separate the result from it and you just look at the format itself, I actually really like the format. I think three games is so much better than one, because if you did run into a Luis Castillo or someone who's just having the game of their life, you don't want your season to end in one game at the hands of someone who's just performing like that, a starting pitcher who's totally dominant. I like that a team has to push, win that second game, really earn it. The Mariners obviously did. They played very well to get there. And I think that in years to come, we're going to see a lot of game threes. We're going to see more game threes. And those games have the chance to be really special too. So I don't know where you land on it, but I actually really like the format after 1 year.
It was interesting from like a strategy perspective and thinking about how teams would approach it, thinking about how they'd construct their rosters, who starts game one, who starts game two, how do you deploy your bullpen? Like, do you shift, do you not shift? Like, it was interesting to see how teams do things differently a little bit in the three game series versus the regular season. I still think it's really unsatisfying to have a 162 game regular season and then have three teams that qualify for the playoffs get only two games. Right. And like, for as salty as Blue Jays fans are going to be after the result that they experienced, I mean, how tough is it to be a New York Mets fan right now and to see your team win 101 games and lose the division in a tiebreaker to the Atlanta Braves, right? Like 101 games, like what did, Cleveland win to win their division? Like 91 maybe, right? Like 10 games less, something like that. Maybe they won 92. I mean, and then the Mets go out in a wild card series. I still think that's really unsatisfying, but like what I would do is like way, grander and never going to happen, in that I would like shorten the regular season substantially and expand the postseason substantially. And I would have like a 140 some game regular season, even whatever the number is that makes the math correct. And then I would expand the postseason field, and I would have I would have longer rounds, and I would do it sort of like just like a tournament, right? Like first round, second round, third round into a championship. And it's like maybe 5 or 7 game series right from the jump. So that's what I would do. But what I would do is never going to happen.
Here's an idea. What if the two teams facing off in the wild card series are separated by 10 or more regular season wins, then the team with more wins automatically begins that series up 1-0.
Sure. Yeah, you could do that. You could even make the series like just anyway, just the home team's up 1-0, right? The home team's got to win one and the road team's got to win two.
But that'd be tough if the teams are really close in record. That would be like a massive advantage. But I kind of like it if there's like a big gap in regular season wins.
Yeah, but I mean, how much of an advantage was home field for the Blue Jays? They lost two straight,
I think in
how much of an advantage is home field for the Cardinals? Lost two straight.
Well, it's not everything, but I think it's something.
Yeah. It's interesting. We should talk about game two of the Blue Jays wild card series because there is a lot to get to. But I do, first of all, since we're talking about home field and since we're talking about like the advantage of home field, did you sense, as I did, that the game two crowd was like way more engaged than the game one crowd and actually had an impact on the game at several junctures?
There's no comparison. And this is not to cast blame on the game one fans. Luis Castillo effectively removed that crowd from the game with the help of Cal Raleigh. So they were out of it. And that lead 4-0 in game one, it felt like 6-0. The Jays got three runners to second base. That was it. It was a one-sided game. So contrast that. Game two, the crowd is in it right away. The Blue Jays take an early lead thanks to Teoscar Hernandez. They keep adding on. The crowd gets progressively more into it. They're on Robbie Ray. They are making an impact. And I thought it was best case scenario. The crowd was loud. They were getting on the Mariners. They were supporting the Blue Jays. And this is, you know, a tiny, tiny silver lining in everything. Now those Blue Jays players have experienced what it is like to play in front of that home crowd and feel that support. They know that support is there. Tiny silver lining doesn't in any way make up for the disastrous outcome that followed.
Yeah, no, totally. That crowd was unbelievable. It's one of the most insane atmospheres like I've witnessed at Rogers Center. I've been at game five of the ALDS. Like I've been very fortunate to be doing this job as of you and to have been at every Blue Jays play, you know, postseason game since 2015.
Well,
and
I mean, almost every.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. We weren't in Tampa. I forgot about that. Yeah. We weren't at the Trop.
Do those even count?
Yeah. Bo Bichette will tell you those weren't postseason games.
I agree with Bo.
Yeah. Anyway, every postseason game at the Rogers Center, I'll say. And I mean, that's just up there. It's one of the most electric, amazing atmospheres I've ever seen. Like, huge credit to the fans. They were an impact on that game. There are so many junctures in that game that'll be forgotten and glossed over. Like we talked about, like Teoscar's game, like the way that he dialed in his approach and wasn't swinging at sliders and then actually hit one out. Chapman's slide into first place, into first base, a non-call for Alejandro Kirk late in the game. Could have been a walk, right? Missed call behind home plate. The way the Blue Jays battled George Kirby late in that game, man. Like, it was like they really made him earn that save. They really made him earn what everything that he got in that outing. Like, that the plate approaches in that final inning were unbelievable. Danny Jansen had like this unbelievable series. I mean, there's so many things that we won't even touch on, but we can start with like the first like big juncture that everyone is gonna remember in a really big way. And that's top of the sixth inning, right? Kevin Gausman, pitch count getting up. The inning begins, what? Ty France single, Suarez single, Cal Raleigh single, right? And then Gausman comes back. He strikes out Mitch Haniger. He faces Adam Frazier, pops him up. And then John Schneider goes to the bullpen for Tim Mesa, brings in Mesa, wild pitch, run scores. Down in the zone to Carlos Santana, boom, over the left center field wall. So like a couple things that could have gone differently there. Bringing in Mesa v. not bringing in Mesa, and then defensive replacement in left, which was Tapia for Merrifield, who had been hit in the head the inning prior, I want to say. Do you do either of those things differently?
Well, I mean, obviously with hindsight, yes. At the time, I think... Man, Santana too, we should mention, he had taken Gausman to deep, deep right center field, literally the top of the wall on a at-bat earlier in the game. So Santana, who's hit the Jays hard all season, clearly was seeing Gausman well. I don't have a problem taking Kevin Gausman out of the game at that point. I really don't, personally. Now, Tim Mesa did not deliver, and that's unfortunate because he had finished the season really strong. And he had been really effective for the Blue Jays this season. And he did not deliver. Wild pitch and allowed the home run. And he did not deliver. Now, as for the defensive replacement, this was not, even though Merrifield was hit on the head, I get the sense this was just a baseball swap. This was to bring in Tapia. And I think at that point in the game, they're thinking, okay, combination, offense and defense. Obviously, you're not starting Tapia against a lefty. So, once Robbie Ray's out of the game, okay, Tapia is likely to face some righties. Get him in there. You're kind of splitting it down the middle at that point. you're saying, okay, we're going to get a little bit of defense and we're going to get a little bit of offense. I think in hindsight, probably makes sense to go to Jackie Bradley Jr. in that spot. Didn't happen. And I wasn't sitting there thinking that at the time. So I'm certainly not trying to say like this was the obvious move. But I think in hindsight, with having the benefit of slowing everything down, knowing how much the Blue Jays were up already, probably makes sense to go to your outfielder at that point, your defensive stalwart at that point in the game.
Yeah, I think the thought was this position in the batting order is coming back up again. And we'd rather have Raimel Tapia's bat there and rather than Jackie Bradley Jr.'s. That's understandable. I would understand it more in a tighter ball game than it was at that point. I mean, at that point, it's 9-1, right? Am I remembering that correctly? It's 8-1, right? It's 8-1 at that point. So I'm probably going Jackie Bradley Jr. in that spot myself if I like really, really thinking about it. It's like, yes, there is an impact offensively. Like, yes, Tapia's, you know, a better hitter at this point in his career, I think, and shown you more this year. But defensively, I'd rather have Jackie Bradley Jr. there in center, which is what's interesting about it, right? Because it wouldn't be Jackie Bradley Jr. playing left for Whit Merrifield. It would have been Jackie Bradley Jr. in center and likely George Springer shifting to right and Teoscar Hernandez shifting to left. So the real question...
Or maybe JBJ in right, keep Springer in center, but I think you're probably right that they would have put JBJ in center.
George Springer playing banged up anyway, right? Like, I really do think it would have been JBJ in center, Springer in right, Teoscar moving to left. So then the real question is, the Cal Raleigh flare off Kevin Gausman that dropped in front of a diving Raimel Tapia, who, by the way, left like an insane divot on that field. I saw it after the game. He made a serious impact with that turf. Good luck, Tom Farrell and the Blue Jays grounds crew in trying to clean that up. But would Teoscar Hernandez have gotten to that 55% catch probability ball? I don't know.
I don't think you can bank it. I don't think you can bank on it. Maybe. He's a fast runner. It's all about the read. It's all about the read you get. You can't lock that in. You can't guarantee that.
So I'll put that one aside and say, all right, so the bases are loaded, right? And Kevin Gausman strikes out Mitch Haniger. Tim Mayza was warming, and I thought Mayza for Frazier was the move. I thought not only am I okay with the Blue Jays lifting Kevin Gausman where they did, I thought they should have lifted him a batter earlier. Frazier has owned Kevin Gausman over his career. Coming into the game, Frazier was 13 for 32 against Kevin Gausman. And like, yes, small sample and like batter versus pitcher stuff, like it's not worth that much, but I mean that it's worth something, man. And Frazier singled off him his last time up, right? Yeah, his last time up, Frazier had singled off of him too, right? So, and those two guys, by the way, have been playing against each other since college. Like, go back to SEC days, and those guys were playing against each other. He knows Kevin Gausman really well. So I thought Tim Mayza for the lefty, Frazier there, and you know, see if you can get your ground ball double play. Like, if you don't, you have Mayza in to face Santana after that, which like isn't an ideal matchup, but you feel okay with it. Turned out the Blue Jays' thinking was leave Gausman in to get Frazier, which he did, and then bring Mayza in for Santana. I promise you that's a matchup they wanted. And the Blue Jays have access to Baseball Reference. They know what the splits are. They know that Carlos Santana has hit better against lefties over the course of his career and that the splits are rather dramatic in that direction in 2022. I don't know the exact thought process behind it, and I doubt the Blue Jays are going to share their information with us. I would imagine it's something to do with the way that Tim Mayza's sinker behaves on the way to the plate and its action versus Carlos Santana's like swing plane and his path to the ball with his bat. I'm sure that the Blue Jays felt that there was something in that matchup that they could exploit. I think Tim Mayza was trying really hard to locate at the bottom of the zone. And I think that because his first pitch was a wild pitch. His first pitch was like in the dirt. So I think he was really trying to hone in on that bottom part of the zone. And I know that also because you look at the pitch that Santana hit out, pretty good pitch by Tim Mayza. Down and away, right at the knees, bottom of the zone sinker. For Carlos Santana to like bend over at the hips at this point in his career and seeing what he's done this year and somehow get under that pitch and drive it out of the ballpark, that's an incredible piece of hitting on his part.
That one is hit high to left field. Tapia going back, all the way back at the wall. It is gone! Carlos Santana from his stronger side takes Meza deep.
He makes the adjustment to go down and reach it. You see that back knee get to that pitch. He just missed the same location, knew they were going to go back there.
So I guess like what I'm saying here is I really wouldn't criticize the Blue Jays for the move. Like, I just think that the moves made sense, and I think they had their reasons to make them, and I think they put themselves in the position they wanted to be in there with Meza versus Santana. It just didn't work out.
Was it 91? Do you know offhand what the velo was for that Meza pitch to Santana?
I can look it up rather
quickly.
I want
to say quickly. 91. Yeah.
91,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. And so that's where it's like, you know, the decision makes sense. You don't know exactly what a guy's going to come out with. Like Castillo, for example, came out throwing harder. Manoa came out throwing a bit harder. Meza, you want that pitch to be harder, ideally. 91's not very fast for major league hitters. I mean, we heard from Whit Merrifield, Carlos Santana didn't come out and say it, but I bet if you asked him, like, man, can you hit 91? Yeah, he can hit 91. He's done it his whole career. So it's just like, you know, the decision makes sense. The execution wasn't there. To me, it's like, and I'm not saying it was a horrible pitch. It's not like it was center cut, but, you know, ultimately, there's a reason that Munoz is so hard to hit at 103. Like, it's literally 12 mile an hour difference. So, you know, that's, and Meza, again, he's been so good for this team all year. This loss is not on Tim Meza, but in that instance, he did not execute to the peak of his ability.
I think the criticism at that juncture is player personnel. And is John Schneider not having a swing and miss option at that point that he could go to and feel okay using there in the sixth and be like, yep, and I've still got horses for later, right? Because like he doesn't want to go to, you know, Jordan Romano, his best swing and miss option in that spot. He wants to save Jordan Romano for later. So if the Blue Jays had just like one more like high velo, big action, big stuff reliever in their bullpen, somebody who can miss a bat in that spot with the bases loaded and two outs in the sixth inning, that's what they needed. So I don't think it's on Tim Meza. I don't think it's on John Schneider. I think it's on having just one less swing and miss reliever than you needed.
I agree. And we'll get to what happened later, but I agree. And I think like, and look, no one wants to hear me go back and relitigate the trade deadline, but we were saying this then. It would have been useful. It would have been very useful. And they could have used one more arm. And look, like, is anyone really happy, like, sitting here today being like, oh my God, I'm so glad that, you know, Aurelvis Martinez is still in the Blue Jays system. And it's, I don't know, but maybe people are, but like a playoff win would have probably felt pretty good too. Not to say that one guarantees the other. It's so easy in hindsight. It's not that simple, but I know.
Yeah, right. Like, because we can do all these things. Like, well, if they had had JBJ in there, would X have happened? And if they had gone to this guy, would Y have happened? If they left Kevin Gausman in, would Z have happened? Like, yeah, but if you do any of this stuff differently, do you just rip open an entirely new space-time continuum? Sure. And all kinds of different stuff happens, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I'm only going to second-guess the Jays on the stuff that I was first guessing them on, you know? So that's where, okay, I don't feel like we were saying at the deadline they could have used one more arm. In the wildcard game, they could have used one more arm. So, okay. So what happens from there?
And also, as we said at the time, it wasn't for a lack of trying by the Blue Jays. I think it's fair to also say that they pushed for relievers. They felt they made good offers, but they didn't go as far in those offers as other clubs did, thinking about guys like David Robertson.
And ultimately, of course, you're going to try. That's your job to try. It's also your job to get it done. It's not, you know, you got to get it done. Trying for relievers is not enough. You either get the player or you don't.
So we move forward to the eighth inning, and that is where you have the Eugenio Suarez off of Anthony Bass. It was like a full count, and Bass gets right up in his kitchen with like 96, and he lifts a flare into left. Raimel Tapia doesn't get to it. He was shifted to right center. Again, Blue Jays hadn't made a defensive replacement for Jackie Bradley Jr. at that point. Tapia had batted an inning prior. I think the Blue Jays got a little bit greedy there. And George Springer was due to lead off the bottom of the eighth. And I think they thought, all right, let's get one more George Springer plate appearance, and then we're bringing in Jackie Bradley Jr., right? Like, I understand that. You want Springer at the plate more than you want Bradley at the plate in that situation. But there is an alternate timeline where you make that substitution. Either if it's straight for Tapia, or what I think it more likely would have been Jackie Bradley Jr. in center, Teoscar Hernandez, Well, maybe it still would have been Tapia and left. I don't know. Either way, it was Tapia going for that ball and left, and he didn't get to it. That's one decision. And then there's also not, well, I guess it's a decision going to Anthony Bass in that spot, and not bringing back out Jimmy Garcia, who had pitched well in the seventh. My understanding is the Blue Jays were kind of operating on like two tracks there, because in the seventh they had a 3-run lead, right? And if the lead had stayed at 3 runs, I think Garcia was coming back out to face Suarez, and then Romano was going to start with Rally if the lead stayed at 3 runs. But then Danny Jansen in the seventh drove in Teoscar Hernandez to extend the lead to 4. And I think that's when the Blue Jays' thinking changed. And it was, okay, let's bring in Anthony Bass to face, you know, the first 3 hitters of the 8th inning and see if we can get through the 8th with Anthony Bass, who, by the way, like top 10 reliever by ERA this season, very good over the last 2 years. Like, there's not a ton of guys in the game you'd rather have in that spot than him. He's been very good. We have to give him credit at some point for what he's done and how good he's been. He has velocity. He has swing and miss stuff. Let's get Anthony Bass to the 8th, have Romano for the 9th, maybe saves a little bit of Romano for a potential game 3. But then Bass gives up the Suarez ball to left that drops, you know, past Tapia. And then Rally and Haneker both go outside the zone to put balls in play that like were off the plate. I mean, just a super unfortunate hard luck outing for Anthony Bass when he doesn't get it done. But just looking back at the decisions that were made and the balls that were put in play, hard for me to be too critical of it again.
Yeah. So on this case, I'm going to start with the trade deadline, because here, good job with the Blue Jays. You got Anthony Bass. That was a good trade. I don't think anyone's going to regret Jordan Groshans going on to be a major league utility player for the Marlins. Whatever. You got Anthony Bass. It was a playoff year. Good for you. And he can help next year. That was a very good trade. Bass was brought in for swing and miss stuff against righties. He just didn't quite get the swing and miss. So again, to me, I would never pin this loss on one player or one person, but Bass, for his role in this game, did not deliver. He had a role. He was supposed to get swing and miss. Weak contact is better than hard contact, but it's worse than no contact. And Bass was brought in for some no contact. And so, again, not pinning too much of this on him before this moment. Unfortunately, that's on the player.
I think if you go back and you look at the Rally swing and the Haneker swing, like, I don't think that Bass throws those pitches any differently. Honestly, they're both outside the zone. Outside the zone. The Mariners did a really good job of putting in play. And then the Suarez ball, that's in the zone, but that is like up and into Suarez. That ball had like a 79 mile per hour exit velo, right?
Okay.
And it's a lazy fly ball to left, and Tapia has 101 feet to cover and only covers 96 of them. That's tough to pin that on Bass.
Yeah, well, okay, ultimately, you know, this is a results game, and so I'm going to pin some of that on Bass. I am. It's a results game. You're in the playoffs. Maybe that's got to be 6 inches further outside. I don't know. I haven't watched the pitches enough times to say, but it's a results game. It's a results business. It's cruel. It's harsh. But to me, some of this has to be on the player. And in this case, it's Anthony Bass. Now, I will say that on the other side of it, and this is not a Seattle Mariners podcast, and it is not about to become one, so don't worry. I'll make this brief. But give the Mariners some credit, man.
They're down
8-1 on the road. 8-1 on the road, and they come back. Like, you flip this around and it's like, what a remarkable display of focus and performance by the Mariners. Okay, that's done. Back to the Jays.
Buddy, extend it to the Frazier ball off of Romano. So when Romano finally comes in after Bass comes out, again, another pitch above the zone. And like Adam Frazier just like hacks it into the outfield. Like, they did some amazing bat to ball work late in this game. The Mariners did. Like, give their hitters full credit for what they did. So Romano's on now, right? Or do you want to say, like, would you have made a different reliever choice at the beginning of the 8th? Other than bringing up Bass, would you have brought Garcia back?
Romano right there.
No, top of the 8th, starting the 8th. Would you have brought back Garcia? Yeah, totally fine.
I'm fine with Bass there.
Yeah, totally fine with John Schneider choosing Anthony Bass there.
Yeah.
And then he gives up the 3 singles and he's quick. And he's like, all right, done. Going to Jordan Romano.
Yeah.
Going to my closer for 6 outs, right? Adam Frazier, I mean, goes to left on a ball above the zone. Like, I don't, like, well above the zone at 96. I don't know what the hell you want Jordan Romano to do there. Then Romano comes back, strikes out Carlos Santana, strikes out Dylan Moore, right? barrage of sliders, and the slider is working. The break on it, the velo on it, the action on it, the location.
It's his best pitch.
It's his best pitch, and he was throwing it well, and he had it. He had it on the day. And then first pitch, J.P. Crawford, slider. And did it catch too much plate? Yes. But did J.P. Crawford get much barrel on it? Hell no. 70 miles per hour off the bat, and he just lifts it to the perfect part of shallow center field / deep second base, where Bo Bichette and George Springer, two like absolute gamers who are playing as hard as possible with maximum intensity and effort and aggressiveness, are going for that baseball, and they collide and they are sprawled out, and both of them, like neither of them are getting up. The ball has trickled away. All the runners were off with the pitch because it's two outs, so the Blue Jays had no shot of doing anything anyway.
Swing and a pop up into shallow center. Springer coming hard, and he will make the catch. The ball is in, and three runs are going to come in to score, and the Mariners have tied it.
And even worse, Buck, there's some injuries out there. That was hit into no man's land. Bo Bichette and George Springer collided.
Tie ball game. How do you sum up what happened on that play?
Oh, man. There's no way, really. I think when we zoom out, that's probably the play that sticks with people years from now. You know, when people are talking about this season, that's the play where it's like the Jays were up 8-1, and then, you know, no one's going to be talking about the pitch selection by Anthony Bass, but we will see that replay of Bo and George crashing hundreds of times, unfortunately. I mean, that's the moment where it went totally sideways for the Blue Jays. And you cannot fault Bo Bichette, not fault George Springer. They are going max effort to make a baseball play, and they could not do it. And you know, J.P. Crawford could not have thrown that ball any better. It was perfectly placed. It was exactly where it had to be to create maximum havoc, to take the energy out of the Blue Jays, to take the energy out of the stadium. And from that point, it was even at that point, but it was really tilted in some ways from a momentum standpoint to the Mariners' favor, and the Blue Jays were on their heels.
If Jackie Bradley Jr. is playing center field and John Schneider doesn't want to get George Springer that one more plate appearance leading off the bottom of the eighth, if he brings in Jackie Bradley Jr. to play center field, do things go any differently?
I don't know, man. I don't maybe. So. Like, there's a chance.
A
chance. It's not a guarantee, though. You know, you can dream of a best case scenario where JBJ gets like maybe a better jump and he's in there quick enough and calls off Bo, and Bo peels away at the last second. Like, maybe, but it's also possible it goes the exact same way, or it's possible JBJ gets a worse jump and he's a step behind and there's no crash, but there's still like, who knows? Who knows?
I don't second guess anything that happened there. I don't second guess the pitch. I don't second guess the deployment. I don't second guess Bo Bichette. Bo Bichette's just playing like as hard as he possibly can and trying to make it out with his team's season on the line. Like, I will never ask a player to give anything less than absolute maximum effort. And that's what Bo Bichette was doing. Is it George Springer's ball? Like, is it the center fielder's ball? Yes. Yes, it is the center fielder's ball, but it's right on the boundary, man. Like, it's right on the boundary. There are certain infield defensive alignments where, like, the second baseman or the shortstop actually would be closer to that ball because of how you're shifted and just because of where you're starting from, right? So, I mean, it's the center fielder's ball if you're playing everything absolutely straight up in the way that, like, infielders would be positioned in a video game, but that's just not it. It's real life, and infielders are positioned in different places. So yeah, I think it was like right on the boundary, and I think that they both went for it as hard as possible, and they both laid absolutely everything on the line, and it didn't work out.
Yeah, you had to almost look away at that point. Like, it was, well, I know you couldn't because you're in the broadcast booth, so that must have been quite a moment to the game that you were calling, by the way, was much more eventful than game one when I was in there with Wagner. But, I looked away. Like, I was standing up beside, I think I was talking to a Rash at that point, and I just looked away. I just had to, you know, it was, and Springer too, you know, we honestly, at this point, as we record this, we're not even sure what happened to George Springer. We know that he was hit maybe in the head neck area. Bichette's arm was hit really hard in that collision. We're not even sure what happened to George Springer. We just know that he had to be carted off the field at that point.
Yeah. We know he was talking to his teammates after the game. They said something to the Blue Jays clubhouse after the game. So that's positive and that's encouraging. But yeah, he didn't look right as he, you know, as he was getting up or being helped up after that hit and being, you know, driven off on a cart. Like, my goodness, what a gutting moment. Like, just unbelievable drama in this ball game. Bo Bichette, I mean, an inning later is stealing a base at full speed, full effort, like running as hard as he can. Like, he was banged up in that play, man. Like, he, it wasn't only his arm, like, yeah, Springer kneed him right in the jaw. Like, that was a football collision. And there's Bo Bichette, like, an inning later, stealing a base at high speed. And then, you know, after the game, you and I, we were both talking to him and just like offering like really, you know, thoughtful like perspective on his season and like just kind of putting like summing things up and like not, you know, sitting at his locker like broken, covered in ice, or, you know, just like not like disheveled, like just like Bo Bichette, ultimate pro, ultimate competitor. Like, there, you know, people dissect Bo Bichette's game six ways from Sunday, and I get it, but there is absolutely no questioning that guy's compete level, that guy's effort, that guy's heart. I know this is like cliche sports radio talk, but I really feel it, man. After watching him play the last two seasons, like every single day, the effort this guy puts in, the way this guy works, we see him before games too and after games too. Like, we see the commitment and the dedication and just like just the amount of energy mentally and physically that he puts into baseball. It's super, super impressive, man. It's incredible.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, the consistency is there. He's a player who, I think off the field, he's someone who's very controlled and very intentional, very deliberate. On the field, he gives, obviously, we saw in that play, he gives everything he has. Also, you know, Bichette saying that this was the hardest year of his life on and off the field, and, you know, didn't get into the details of that in the context of the post-game environment right there. But he was saying the hardest year of his life and also the most rewarding year of his life in a lot of ways. So he's gone through a lot, certainly, and the results were there. I mean, you know, this isn't a regular season kind of recap podcast because of everything that happened in game two, but he had a very, very good year and certainly showed up for the Blue Jays in the playoffs.
Ninth inning, Romano back out. What happens? He comes out and what's he do? Strikes out Suarez, and then it's double to rally, fastball up, not his best pitch. I'm sure the scouting report said throw rally fastballs because that's what he was throwing him. He wasn't throwing him his slider, and he clearly felt really strong about his slider on the day. So tough result when Rally gets you with the fastball, and then what? He pops up Haniger, and then it's Adam Frazier again with like another fantastic piece of hitting against a slider down and in to a left-handed hitter. Again, good spot, I thought. Was it a little bit up? Maybe, but like Jordan Romano's 29th pitch of the night, and it was a similar location where he's like gotten swing and miss from Suarez, right? Where he got like weak contact from Moore. It was a good pitch for him on the night. It was his slider. Jordan Romano, like, talking to him after the game, was like, man, it's tough to get beat there, you know, in the way that I did when I feel like I pitched really well and I feel like I had my like good stuff. Like, Jordan Romano will tell you there's been days this year and nights where he takes the mound without his best stuff and without his command, and gets good results, where he's not feeling his best and the velo's not there and the movement or whatever, he doesn't know where the ball's going, and he like gets good results and he records saves. But I think Jordan Romano really felt like on Saturday he went out with his premium stuff and still got beat. I think that's what makes it really tough to swallow.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this, you know, you look at the results, and did he pitch two full innings in the end? I don't know if you have the box score.
No, he got lifted
in front of me. He got lifted.
No,
right?
Yeah, he got lifted for Simber.
Right, of course. So Simber finished it out. But, you know, Romano threw 30 pitches essentially. He was out there in the high leverage moment. I think the decision to bring Romano in made sense. I think the decision to take him out made sense. His execution, it's hard to find a ton of fault with the execution there, as you're saying. And so, you know, the common theme here is like,
it was baseball.
It's baseball. It's like, I'm not sure that there's, yeah. And Bo Bichette said that in talking to us afterwards as well. But it's like, you know, I forget who asked the question, but his answer started with just like baseball. Like, this is just this. It happens, and it's. I think that's the best summary, and maybe that's unsatisfying. I don't know. Maybe there's some people listening and saying, "Come on, guys! Like, we spent an hour listening to you just dissect this series, and there's no one to blame." But that's actually kind of how I feel. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say like John Schneider cannot come back as the manager of this team. Like, he blew it. No, that's not how I view it. I think he can come back. In fact, I think he should come back. I'm not going to pin this on any one player. It's devastating. They were up 8-1. They absolutely should have won this game. But I don't see it as a collapse. I see it as a crushing, crushing defeat. And they should have won the game. They should have won the game. They should still be playing. But I have trouble pinning this on any individual person or decision.
Yeah, and that's reflected in the 99% win probability going into the sixth inning. Up 8-1. You should win that game. And 99% of the time, teams
you have to win that game.
Yeah. It's baseball, man. It's like I said off the top, the game's cruel. Like, it's irrational. It doesn't always make sense. It's not always going to line up with a perfect scapegoat in this, like, ordered, logical reason why things happen. Like, it's a confluence of a million different variables and factors that all come into play. Like, I'm like you, man. I don't come out here and say, oh, they got to fire the GM. Oh, they got to get rid of the manager. Like Ross Atkins should and will be back. I think that John Schneider should and will be back. Like, I don't foresee any major like changes outside of personnel, like player personnel, which is something we can talk about later.
Yeah. And we have time to get to the player personnel stuff.
Yeah.
I'll say real, real quick on that front. Ross Stripling, talked to him. He's open to coming back. David Phelps, if he loved his time in Toronto, he's another free agent. Potentially open to coming back. If he plays, I think he would be very open to coming back to Toronto. But again, we'll get to that. We have months and months of off-season talk ahead. But yeah, I mean, even you mentioned Ross Atkins, right? Like, the GM, like, you could...
One more reliever with swing and miss. That's the one thing I'd put on him. More swing and miss reliever.
I agree with that. And at the same time, there's a 91-win team last year. It's a 92-win team this year. It's a good team. It's a really good core moving forward. They're in a good spot. We are going to see changes. We are going to see changes, in my opinion, to the roster, to the coaching staff. All of that is likely ahead. But I think John Schneider, it didn't work. It backfired. That is a manager's nightmare. That might be the worst game in some ways of John Schneider's career. Even if he manages for 20 years in the big leagues, that might be a game that sticks with him in 2042. Like, honestly, it's that kind of game. That is a manager's nightmare. Does that mean it was his fault? I don't think so. I really don't. I think it all went wrong. But I don't think it's his fault, and I think he's a good manager.
Did John Schneider manage any differently in that game than he did in the regular season? Right?
No.
When he led this team to a whole bunch of victories over the second half of the year after Charlie Montoyo was dismissed? I mean, I saw a manager in that game trusting the process, trusting the information that he had, right? Like, trusting the plan that was made, adapting based on what's happening in front of him, sure, but like just being really convicted in his decision making and in like the way that the Blue Jays arrive at the decisions that they make. It just didn't work out. But I don't think that it's like realistic to expect this team to all of a sudden become this like gut feel, subjective decision making like group, right? Like, they're objective, right? They're process oriented. This is who they are. They're evidence based. They had a reason for Meza versus Santana. That's a matchup that they wanted. I promise you, going into this series, they talked to Tim Meza and said, hey, there's going to be a moment late in one of these games where we're going to ask you to face Carlos Santana. This is before the first pitch is ever thrown. We're going to ask you to face Carlos Santana, and this is how we want you to pitch him because we like this matchup and the way that your stuff plays vis-a-vis his swing. I mean, this is what they do. And at the end of the day, it's still human performance, right? It's still execution. It's still like on the field. It's more art than science. But like, Blue Jays management, and that's coaches, that's front office, that's analysts, that's tons of people who you'll never even know their names, believes that it is putting those players and those humans performing in the best possible position to succeed by being unemotional and objective and empirical in their decision making. And then they let the results be what they be, and they live with them. But they, if they follow their process, they feel good about that because they're process oriented. And I think that's what John Schneider did in that game. He followed his process. It just didn't work out.
And I think, you know, just as before, we were saying, be careful with narratives here, which, by the way, if I hear a single narrative that wraps everything up and describes it in a satisfying way, I will be sure to pass it on At the Letters. I will be sure to do that. I just, I don't have one right now. And I think along those lines, be careful anytime that you see someone frame this loss as numbers versus gut feel. Just be careful, because to me that says whoever's framing it that way probably has a personal bias against numbers and against analytics, that they're using this game to somehow advance that. To me, I just don't see it that way. And of course, I love numbers. I also love gut feel calls. I love the human element of sports. They're both essential parts of the game. You can't strip any of those away from what happened on the field. So just, I think, probably a word of caution right there.
I do, and when it comes to that human performance as well, like you know, there's no savant category for like 49,000 people at Rogers Center. And like, I know I felt it in like the radio booths and even in game one, the lead into game one, but I especially felt it in game two, where I was like, oh, my emotions are higher right now. Like, like, you know me, man, like I'm pretty one note most of the time. Like I was like, whoa, I felt it. I can't imagine what the players felt on the field. Dude, Matt Chapman talked about like not feeling his hands in the batter's box after Teoscar's home run.
And that's Matt Chapman.
Matt Chapman, who is like one of the most in control, composed players that we watched all year. He talked about having to gather himself.
Yeah, that's Matt Chapman. Because I mean, there are other players where, you know, you could sense some nerves from some players, even at the podium at times, or you can just sense, you know, it's a nervy time like for anyone who's in that stadium, in that setting. But Matt Chapman, to me, was someone who was like at the opposite end of that spectrum. Like he seemed under control all season. And so if he's saying that, it tells you something.
Well, and we talked about it coming into the series, right? That the Blue Jays were going to have techniques, and they're going to have ways of kind of staying composed and staying within themselves and focusing on process and focusing on swing decisions and swinging at the right pitches and not the, you know, and not ones that are outside the zone. For pitchers, incredibly like fine motor skill position, right? Like just the littlest thing is off in your mechanics. You just get the littlest bit sped up here and all of a sudden you're missing the zone, right? Like we talked about how they're going to have ways to sort of stay within themselves in those atmospheres. And like, what did we see in this series? Alek Manoah, first inning, is spraying his fastball, right? In game one. Tim Mayza comes in game two, first pitch, wild pitch in the dirt and runners score. Adam Simber yanked his first pitch coming into the game. Adam Simber walked a dude. Adam Simber walked like 13 people all year. Like Adam Simber does not walk a lot of batters. He came in and walked somebody in that game and like yanked a pitch like I've never seen him yank a pitch, you know? Like when Matt Chapman is talking about how he has to work to control his emotions and like stay in the moment, and that's a guy who's been in multiple wildcard games before and a guy who just naturally runs the very low heart rate, I can't imagine what it was like for younger Blue Jays, for more inexperienced Blue Jays, for guys who hadn't been in that position before. Like this is a team where the talent is through the roof. The desire is obvious. I do just think that perhaps the execution was a little bit undone at times in this series because of the circumstances, because of the atmosphere, because of the stakes. And I think that execution, and Matt Chapman talked to us about this, execution is like the hardest thing to learn. Like executing in the moment is one of the hardest things to learn how to do that at the big league level. It's something that takes time. It takes experience, right? Like finding your intensity and your focus and balancing those things in those moments. It's so crucial and it's so hard. And I wonder if a lot of Blue Jays sort of learned something about what that takes in this series.
I'm sure they did. It would be very surprising to me if they did not. And, you know, I think we might hear, we've already heard John Schneider and some of the players frame this as a positive, frame this as a step forward. Yes, okay. I guess, sure, it's an incremental step forward. I still think this should have been a year where they took many steps forward. Like, dream big, don't just settle for like, and I'm not saying they're happy with this. Of course, they're not happy with this. But this should have been a chance to take many, many steps forward. And so, you know, to me, Arden, like, as I look at this season, I have to say I don't think it's a successful season for the Jays. You know, I think that given the expectations, given the talent, they fired their manager and they got swept in the playoffs. and they blew an 8-1 lead at home. It was a season where they had a lot of successes. It was a season where they had a lot of things go right. And it's a season that in many ways they should still be proud of as individuals and even collectively. I'm not saying there's nothing to be proud of here. And maybe it's a media construct to say success or not success. It's not binary like that. But it's hard on the whole to look at this season, you know, fire your manager, get swept at home in the playoffs and blow an 8-1 lead. To me, it's not a success.
They're missed opportunities. Definitely. Yeah. 2022 and 2021, right? When you think about some of the talent that these teams have had, we've kind of talked about it like all year. Why is the whole of this team so often less than the sum of its parts, right? Like, why do you have two MVP finalists in 2021 and a Cy Young winner? 2022, again, like Cy Young candidates on the roster, like a lineup every day that has maybe one hitter in it with like an OPS plus below 100, some days nine hitters with OPS pluses above 100. How do you have like the, you know, AL best offense this year, second only to the Dodgers? I mean, two absolute beasts atop your rotation, one of the best closers in baseball over the last two seasons. Like, we don't say that enough about Jordan Romano, like one of the, like, second to like Class A, you know, like this guy, he's got a lower ERA over the last 2 years than Edwin Diaz. Okay.
Oh,
he's lower than Liam Hendricks. Yeah. It's lower than Ryan Pressly. They have gotten incredible performances. And these are missed opportunities because you've let all that talent and like all that performance go by the wayside without achieving your goals in the postseason. And because it's going to get harder going forward to keep this core together and to construct rosters. Because, and again, we're going to talk about this in a future episode, but Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is about to take a second trip through arbitration. Bo Bichette's about to, you know, hit arbitration. Like, the low cost surplus value years of this young core are very quickly disappearing. You've still got it on Manoah and you've still got it on Kirk, but Vlad and Bo are now closer to free agency than they are to the beginning of their Blue Jays careers. Like, the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking, man. Like, they've played parts of four seasons. They have three seasons left. We are more than halfway through the pre-free agency years of Bo and Vlad with no sign of extensions coming. So, you know, we may be more than halfway through their tenure as Blue Jays before they hit free agency and sign with the Angels, Cardinals, Yankees, who knows? Blue Jays, could be the Jays, but it's wild to think of that. And also, some of the big money guys are now, you know, Ryu, he's less productive than he was when you first signed him. Springer, who knows? Hopefully he recovers first and foremost to begin with, but who knows? Gausman, you know, he had a great year. Is he going to have great years 4 years from now? Jays obviously hope so. He's showing no signs of slowing up and had a great game, should be mentioned, in game two. Yeah, Barrios. Each one of these chances, Barrios, exactly. You know, six more years right there. So a lot of questions for this team. They had a great chance this year to do way more than they did. And unfortunately for them, it's passed them by.
And then you couple in the fact that there were not many developmental success stories this year. Like, Alek Manoah, obviously, like the biggest one, and incredible that you produced an Alek Manoah. Like, that's an awesome outcome. But the fact that Nate Pearson had another year like he did, the fact that Thomas Hatch, Anthony Kay, you know, Bowden Francis, like, we can go on, Julian Merriweather, like the lack of depth starters that were able to come up and impact this team, the fact that down the stretch your bullpen was your fifth starter, you were regularly throwing bullpen days, 92 win team, like, the, you know, Addison Barger had a very like interesting year in the minors, cool. Like, who else from a position player side is really like putting upward pressure on this roster right now?
Yeah. Like, obviously, you layer Tiedemann in that. Was good, but yeah.
Yes. No, Ricky Tiedemann, 20 years old at AA. Like, great, great story. But you're like advancing him aggressively and pushing him aggressively because, like, you have to. You're looking at a rotation next year right now, which is Manoah, Gausman, Barrios, Kikuchi. Those are your four starters for next year.
Mitch White, probably your five.
Two of the massive, massive question marks, right? Yep. And I mean, we saw Mitch White's performance down the stretch. I'm high on Mitch White. I think that there's a lot of untapped potential there and a lot of things he can do differently. But the performance at the big league level down the stretch was obviously unimpressive. So, like, you layer that stuff in as well. And I agree with you. Like, two missed opportunities in 21 and 22 to do something greater.
Yep. No doubt about that.
That's a dour note. Dour way.
It should be, man. If there's ever a time to end a podcast on a dour note, it should be this time. Like, they had an 8-1 lead at home when they blew it. Like, there's no way we're going to end this and have people feel that. I hope people feel a bit better. I don't know how therapeutic or what this was to listen to for more than an hour. So thanks to everyone who stuck with us for that long. But like, there's no way you were coming out of this podcast feeling like, well, I'm actually happy about the Jays now.
Actually, it's a good thing that they had the second worst collapse in MLB history.
Yeah,
I read that in your story. 1929.
Philadelphia Athletics.
Right. It was a name of a franchise that was like they had that name at that point. That's how long ago it was. Well, there's your silver lining. It could always be worse. It could have been 1929, right? It could always be worse. It wasn't that bad. So there you have it. Thanks for listening all year, everybody. This is very, very much appreciate everybody who listens to Athletics, who writes us, lets us know on Twitter, lets us know in person. It's always very heartening to hear that people enjoy the podcast. We enjoy doing it, and we're looking forward to continuing to do it, because while Ben and I might get about 45 minutes maybe to catch our breaths here, the off season's right around the corner. And we got over-unders to recap. We got an off-season to set up. We're going to talk to Ross Atkins, his year-end media availability on Tuesday. Today's Monday, October 10th. He's going to talk tomorrow. We're going to learn more. And then we're going to just spin forward into the abyss. So thanks, Christian Ryan. Thanks to Nick Andrade. Those guys do great work and were with us all year. And we thank them for their heavy lifting. He's Ben Nixon-Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next time on At The Letters.